You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, binge drinking, smoking, opioid addiction. Those are some of the targets of a new state effort to boost public health in Wisconsin. We'll find out what might work.
Now, President Trump's alleged ties to Russia have plagued him from the time he was a candidate. The newest issue dogging the White House is the charge that Trump's son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner, is being investigated by the FBI for allegedly trying to establish back-channel communications with Russian officials between the election and Inauguration Day.
This is the latest in a series of issues ranging from potential Russian meddling in the election to former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn refusing to turn over potentially incriminating documents to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and even the president himself allegedly trying to convince then-FBI Director James Comey to stop investigating ties with Russia.
Lowell Barrington joins us now. He's an associate professor and the chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Lowell, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
I want to start with the latest news from over the weekend. It was reported that President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is now one of the people being investigated for allegedly seeking to establish a kind of back-channel communication line to Russia. Now, first of all, how unusual is this?
Well, it would not be unusual for an American government official working in foreign policy, especially at a high level, to try to establish contacts with people that that person might be able to work with on delicate issues. What's unusual about this is that, in fact, this happened during the transition, and I think also the idea that Jared Kushner had not had an appointed official position at that point, and certainly was not, President Trump was not even in office at that point. Those are all make it a little unusual. I think the most concerning part for people who work on foreign policy matters was the idea, and again, if these reports are true, that he was talking about establishing that secure line using a Russian government location within the United States, either an embassy or consulate.
And by some reports, the Russians themselves seem to have been taken aback by this. And there were some in diplomatic circles and foreign policy circles who said, you know, that if true, this demonstrates to them, they saw it as an example of kind of naivete to a large degree or something else. How do you see it?
Well, I think one of the things that Rob just said before is really important, which is this is just one of a series of issues. So in that context, as we look at the variety of things about Russia, I think it has importance. But it also certainly does point to, and I would say in a very similar way to President Trump's slip of classified information, talking to Sergei Lavrov and Sergei Kislyak in the Oval Office earlier in May, just shows a lack of understanding about the seriousness of certain issues related to foreign policy that, again, would be of concern to those both who are practitioners and scholars of foreign policy and foreign affairs.
Now, clearly, we don't know the answers to the why, but do you have any thoughts about why the Trump team would have interest in securing that kind of back-channel communication with Russia before they were installed in the White House?
Well, there are a number of possibilities, and again, this assumes, again, that the reports are true and that this was the focus of the conversation. One of the obvious ones would be there was already by then an awareness of monitoring, for example, of Sergei Kislyak by the United States, so that this would be one way, if you had a secure line at a Russian facility, that they may be able to better evade intelligence oversight of those communications. And I think that's one of the ones that would be certainly concerning to a lot of people if that was the goal. Otherwise, again, the other thing that was going on, of course, was you had a effort at that point to reestablish additional sanctions because of Russia's role in the American elections. And there may have been a thought that it just would have been better to do this kind of quietly behind the scenes rather than to openly look like the transition team was trying to undermine, at that point, current American policy.
We're looking right now at the latest news about Russian interference in the American election in 2016 with Lowell Barrington, associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. And Lowell, before we leave this particular news item, what kind of position do you think this puts Jared Kushner in?
Well, he's certainly in a difficult position, and one of the many ironies of this, as you may know, he's had a huge number of roles that have been given to him in the short time that the Trump administration has been in place. But one of the newest ones was going to be that he was supposed to play a kind of key role in what people were calling the war room within the White House to deal with the Russia crisis and Russia scandal. And certainly it's very difficult to head an effort at trying to downplay the seriousness of the Russia issue if you are now a central figure in that. I think it's also very serious for him because, again, if the reports are correct, he was not the only one at the meeting, that in fact Michael Flynn was at this meeting as well. And I think I would be very concerned looking back now at comments that Michael Flynn made or his lawyers have made about him having an interesting story to tell and whether this might be part of that story.
As you said, we don't know yet whether these allegations are true, but some Democrats are calling for Kushner's security clearance to be revoked. Do you see that as something likely to happen?
Well, I think there would probably have to be a little bit more information to come out. I think, again, it's been interesting to see when the president has turned on people like Michael Flynn, despite many, many efforts and positive statements by the president about him. In this case, of course, you have the added dimension. This is his son-in-law, and people have become fond of saying it's hard to fire your son-in-law, and I think that there's something to that. He will probably have a bit more line given to him where the White House, at least, certainly would be very reluctant for him to have to surrender that, because that would really add to what looks like, again, a number of problems and real evidence that there is something there, like Michael Flynn stepping down, or, you know, whether it's even something like our attorney general having to recuse himself from the Russia issues.
Now, moving on, CNN is reporting that two former intelligence officials and a congressional source are alleging that intercepted conversations from Russian officials claim to have derogatory information of then-candidate President Trump, then-candidate Trump. What would this mean for the administration?
Well, I think one of the things all along about this is the question of what Russia wanted to get out of this. And I think certainly there is a sense that the lack of experience, not only in American government, but certainly in the political side, at least, of international relations, maybe less so the economic side, but his lack of experience in the political side made him a target that they felt like they could perhaps manipulate. And there are reports, for example, that foreign leaders, before meeting with Trump, and their handlers and consultants talk about the ways to cozy up to him, including giving him some little victory that he can point to out of that meeting. And so I think certainly the Russians, at least some of the Russian officials, seem to have seen this as not someone who would necessarily want to undermine the American, you know, situation with national security, obviously, but someone who they could kind of cozy up to and work with and make him feel comfortable while they were perhaps trying to get some small or not so small concessions on the policy side.
Now, President Trump is freshly back from a 9-day international trip, and he took to Twitter, had said that some of these allegations were fake news, and he's been saying all along that the real story here is the leaks. Is his counter-response gaining traction?
Well, it is true that we should be concerned about leaks of national intelligence matters. At the same time, that doesn't take away from what the leaks are about and whether there is increasing evidence of deep connections between different officials of the transition team and the administration and Russian officials. And so that, yes, I think it's fair to say we should be concerned always about leaks. And in fact, to that point, the situation following the bombing in the UK, the British government had a real right to be very unhappy with American officials who it appears had leaked information, including pictures from that scene. So I think we need to separate those two issues, though. It's not one or the other. We can be concerned about leaks while at the same time understanding there are real reasons to be concerned about Russia's involvement in our election and since.
We're talking with Lowell Barrington right now about the latest news about Russia. He's an associate professor of political science and the chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the ongoing issues and the latest news in this investigation of Russia, last year's election, and the Trump campaign team? What do you think of the latest with Jared Kushner and this alleged meeting with Russian officials? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now about the ongoing scandal plaguing the White House related to alleged campaign ties with Russia and Russian interference in last year's election. Lowell Barrington is with us, associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Russia-U.S. relations and this investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election? What are your thoughts about the potential role that Russia may have played? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And Republican Senator John McCain in Arizona had said in an interview recently that Russian President Vladimir Putin was one of the biggest threats facing the United States. Here's Senator McCain.
I think he is the premier and most important threat, more so than ISIS. I think ISIS can do terrible things, and I worry a lot about what is happening with the Muslim faith, and I worry about a whole lot of things about it. But it's the Russians who tried to destroy the very fundamental of democracy, and that is to change the outcome of an American election. Now, I have seen no evidence they succeeded, but they tried, and they are still trying. They are still trying to change election. They just tried to affect the outcome of the French election. So I view Vladimir Putin, who has dismembered Ukraine, a sovereign nation, who is putting pressure on the Baltics. I view the Russians as the far greatest challenges that we have.
And what about that, Lowell? Strong words from Senator John McCain, who's saying that when it comes to the danger posed, he says Russia and Vladimir Putin is the bigger worry than ISIS. What do you make of that?
Well, those are strong words. I agree with him that ISIS can do terrible things. I think, though, that he raises an interesting point about the threat to elements of democracy. I would add that I think ISIS also poses a threat to democracy in terms of how we respond in restricting liberty and freedoms in response to the terrorist threat. But his point about undermining the legitimacy of core democratic institutions, if we begin to get to a point where we do not trust election outcomes and we do not trust that the leader in power was really the legitimately elected leader, we are down a very dangerous path, and we've seen it in many other countries where the democracy becomes much more fragile once the sense that the elections were really free and fair have been called into question. The other thing that he didn't say quite as much about, but I think is really important, is how the Russia situation, and I would say even how President Trump's recent trip to Europe has affected U.S.-European relations. And I think that's one where ISIS is a threat to both the U.S. and Europe, and I think it, if anything, would bring us together. I think Russia is something that, especially with what looks like a more kind of open and tolerant relationship between the White House and Russia, that has really deepened a divide between the United States, or at least, again, between the White House and key European leaders.
And how damaging do you think that is in the scope of things?
Well, it's interesting. Just yesterday, Emmanuel Macron, the new French president, who was meeting with President Putin, said at a press conference with Putin right there that he had coordinated propaganda that was based on lies as a way of trying to undermine the French election. I think that was a pretty interesting moment. I think long-term, even more important were the comments from German leaders, in particular Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, who said that we really need to now take our fate into our own hands in Europe, which is a way of saying we cannot trust that the United States will necessarily have our interests first and foremost in mind. And that's an incredibly strong statement from a country that we have been very close to since World War II, as we have worked on both economic and political and security relationships in a very close way with throughout that period and throughout the development of the European Union.
And the president has tweeted about that statement from Angela Merkel. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, I want to get a caller on. We have Chuck with us in Ashland. Chuck, hi.
Hi. I just wonder, you know, so some of these things, some of them we can't really know listening and what sort of information the intelligence community might have from their, you know, whatever secret wiretapping or whatever. But some of these things, they go back that Trump was just, you know, unfit for office, such as supposedly sharing some intelligence on an ISIS attack with a Russian ambassador. Or there was another big one recently, some sort of intelligence sharing kind of thing. But, you know, like the Obama administration had established, an anti-terrorism cooperation with Russia, which they were sharing intelligence on. And here's the other thing is, you know, another big one about how Russia, Trump is in the pocket of Russia, was that before shooting the missiles into Syria, he informed the Russians, which is part of a deconfliction agreement established with Russia under the Obama administration so that Russia and the United States aren't shooting each other's planes down.
Okay.
And further, mm-hmm. There's a deeper question about Russiaphobia, which people like William Appleman Williams and other people in the revision at the University of Wisconsin covered during the 60s. And, you know, we're just falling back into this new Cold War thing, and Russia's horrible. You know, and your guests say, oh, the Europeans, they hate Russia and they don't like that Trump might like Russia. But a lot of what I heard is that the Russians have actually been, during the Obama administration, that the Europeans have been more mm-hmm. comfortable with easing the new Cold War with Russia.
Chuck, thank you for your call. Appreciate a lot of points there. I want to make sure we can address some of those with our guest. And Lowell, you know, he's saying maybe we're falling back into old Cold War stances, but that there had been some bridges built prior to President Trump taking office during the Obama administration.
Well, and I think that is a fair point. I mean, Chuck's point that we had both sought better relations with Russia during the Obama administration and that Europe had sought positive relations at times with Russia. I think those are both valid points. I think one of the things that has really changed that, though, in the last couple of years has been the situation with Ukraine and Russia's obvious willingness. And again, there were earlier things we can point to that people should not have been ignoring, but really obvious willingness by Vladimir Putin to push into territory outside the Russian borders today. And I think that has changed Russia's situation in Europe. I think the European leaders are much more skeptical of what his intentions are. And I think it both did change and should have changed our relationship with Russia at that point as well.
Thank you for that call. And we're going to go next to Tom in Loyal. Tom, hello.
Good afternoon. I have two things. One, it seems like Vladimir Putin already made some headway with the Trump administration by them backing off on selling arms to the Ukraine in their fight against Crimea. And secondly, since they're still hacking us, what are we doing to try to protect the 2018 midterm elections?
Tom, thanks for those. And Lowell, what do you say?
Well, both of those are important points. I think that one of the interesting situations during the campaign was, in fact, during the lead-up to the Republican convention when a provision about Ukraine was removed from the Republican platform at a time in which the Trump officials in the campaign were talking already with Russian officials. I think that is a legitimate concern that we should have because, again, it points to not just positive relations, but potentially actually policy consequences of those connections. The question about hacking in the 2018 election is a very important one, obviously, although it's important to point out that the hacking here was not as far as we know, in 2016, hacking of voting machines or anything like that that would have affected the vote count, but much more about putting out misleading or just outright incorrect stories, using techniques to push those very quickly across the internet, working on in comment sections of web pages to post things favorable about Russia and unfavorable, for example, about the Clinton campaign. There were a lot of things they did that are very difficult for us to stop. But I will say one of the tricky things about the cyber side of this is most of what we will do in response, no one will ever know. It's not like a world in which you're lining up tanks on the border and it's obvious and visible to everyone. Most of the things that will be done, whether to prevent something or to retaliate for things in the area of cyber, are things that none of us will actually see.
Thank you for that call. And Lowell, just briefly as we wrap up, you were concerned about divisions developing between the United States and our historical allies in Europe. Donald Trump, President Trump, I think it was this morning, tweeted that Germany was very bad for America. What are you watching as a political scientist in terms of red flags or maybe improvement in relations?
Well, again, I think we should be concerned because, again, this is part of a pattern of, even as a candidate, President Trump talking about not really seeing the importance of elements of NATO and not thinking that the European Union was a good thing, certainly supporting openly the Brexit vote, for example, as a way of dividing countries in Europe from one another. And I think we should be concerned about that because this is a relationship that has helped keep the peace for a long time now. I think it's important to remind ourselves that the two world wars to date that we have had have involved Europe and divisions within Europe. And I think that it's important for us to work to facilitate both close ties and really working to make better connections across Europe and not to divide European countries against themselves. I find the line again from Angela Merkel that we need to take our fate into our own hands as something we may look back on down the road as a really, really significant statement.
Lowell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services released Healthy Wisconsin, an initiative to improve statewide efforts on key health issues. The report includes a call to action to get us to cut back on smoking and binge drinking while doing better on nutrition and exercise.
Dr. Patrick Remington joins us now. He's Associate Dean of Public Health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into specific issues, when it comes to health behaviors, can the state, can policymakers working in conjunction with others really make a difference, or are we just spinning our wheels here?
No, I think it's really important that the state health department play a leadership role in developing plans, not just in isolation, really together with healthcare providers and community organizations, to set goals for where we want to be as a state. These are plans that typically are set every 10 years. But this plan looks at a shorter time frame. It's set for 2020 so that we hope to see substantive change in the next couple of years.
And the five main issues, they cover a lot of ground, but the five action areas involve alcohol, binge drinking in particular, nutrition and physical activity, opioid addiction, suicide prevention, and tobacco use. Do these seem to you like good areas of emphasis for this report?
Absolutely. These are problems that not only lead to a lot of death and disability, but also are modifiable. Some places in the country have put policies into place and have actually seen significant declines in smoking or in rates of obesity. The previous plan that was developed 4 or 5 years ago was very extensive, over 1,000 pages long, with hundreds of goals and objectives. And this is an attempt to focus the attention on high priority issues so that people can begin working together. If you all work together on a few problems, you're more likely to make some progress than if everybody's working alone in isolation.
Now, each of these problems has its own areas of emphasis, different ways to tackle it. But this one common theme kept coming to me in this report. They talk about adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. bad things, abuse, parents with addiction. There's a list of things. This idea that the more of these things a kid is exposed to, the more likely they are to have all this bad stuff. Alcohol problems, bad nutrition, diabetes, opioid addiction, all of it can be traced or at least influenced in part by these adverse childhood experiences. Is this new research that we're learning about now?
Well, it's actually quite interesting because a resident who trained here at Madison in internal medicine did the defining studies to look at these ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and looked at adults with chronic illness. And when you ask them about their early life experiences and compare them to adults without chronic illness, you find that there are common themes that come through, that children often have mental abuse or physical abuse, or come from broken homes or homes where parents have been incarcerated. And these adverse child experiences, when you total them up, there's a dose-response relationship. The more adverse childhood experiences you see in a child, the more likely you are later in life to have chronic illness such as diabetes, cancer, heart disease, substance abuse.
Now, that's scary, but I gather there's some upside. Knowing this, there are interventions we can do, maybe even for kids, young adults, that might help relieve some of those effects?
Well, there's great evidence that these adverse experiences can be prevented in the first place or certainly modified. I think the other interesting aspect of ACEs is that nobody disagrees with working with children who are not given opportunity or who are in these unfortunate situations. It's not like dealing with adults who may be using substances or not exercising or eating right. Many people view that as a choice and that as an adult behavior. But these children who are in these situations where they don't have a good environment to lead a healthy life, everyone agrees that that is something we need to address.
Talking to Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about a new report called Healthy Wisconsin. This is from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. A call to action, in part, on a number of different health measurements here in Wisconsin. We could probably have a whole other conversation about these adverse childhood experiences, but I want to get into these issue areas. Wisconsin, sadly, famous for binge drinking and alcohol problems. By some measures, in this report, they cited a measure where we're 49th or second worst, if you want to look at it that way, when it comes to binge drinking. What kind of public health measures could we take to get our binge drinking rates down?
Well, unlike some topics like opioid abuse or cigarette smoking, where the efforts are to prevent use of those substances, certainly abuse, alcohol is more complicated in that alcohol is used socially and is part of our culture here in Wisconsin. And so the focus needs to be on reducing the abuse of alcohol. And binge drinking is an example. It's defined as having five or more drinks on one occasion, or for women, it's four or more drinks. And that is tightly associated with harm, with injury deaths, with addiction later in life, even sexual assault and intimate partner violence. And so the focus needs to not only be just on telling people that's a bad thing to do, but really understanding culture and understanding how we can substitute hobbies or outings where alcohol is not central. And there have been some programs right here at the University of Wisconsin looking at substitutions like Thursday night or midnight basketball, where you're not telling kids, college kids, not to drink. You're substituting with an alternative which is healthy.
Right, and that's something people have raised, and we've talked to alcohol policy people, the idea that our culture in Wisconsin has normalized regular drinking, frequent drinking, and excessive drinking, to where, you know, we get comments from listeners, well, if you define binge drinking as only five drinks, well, of course we binge drink, because that's a Thursday night. So how it's pretty deep-seated now. How do you really make headway on that?
If it were simple, we wouldn't have been talking about this for 30 or 40 years. It is deeply embedded in culture, and culture changes come much more slowly than simply information campaigns or medical technology. It begins with families, educating their kids. It begins in early school education, and it really begins with a plan like this, where the entire community comes together and defines an issue as a public health problem, and then looks across all the sectors, from the industry, the alcohol industry, the taverns and bars, all the way through to educational institutions and employers, to address the problem, because you won't do it with a simple fix.
I want to move on to another one of the action areas here, nutrition and physical activity. Now, we hear we're supposed to eat, the numbers have varied, but 5 or more servings of vegetables in a day, a number that struck me here. 1 in 4 Wisconsinites, adults we're talking now, eat fewer than 1 serving of vegetables a day. Fewer than 1 sounds like about 0 to me. That sounds like we've got a lot of ground to make up there.
It does, and it's a good example where information alone, it won't be sufficient. We pretty much have saturated the airwaves with advice on how to eat right and exercise. We need to shift to changing the opportunities for healthy eating and for exercise. A good example is just today, I had lunch at the cafeteria at the UW Hospital, and by intent, they've dropped the price of the salad bar so that you cannot eat more than $4 worth of salad. That by discounting the healthy foods, they're bringing people in. Patients, staff, and visitors come to the UW Hospital because of the special discounting of the healthy food, and that economic policy makes it easier to take the advice to eat a healthy diet.
Right, and that can apply at a much larger level. And we've talked about in the past, we can say all we want, hey, kids should get exercise. If you're not in a safe neighborhood to get out and exercise, that's not so easy. We can say, eat your fruits and veggies. If you're in a food desert without convenient access to vegetables, that's hard to do. So how do we start to help structure neighborhoods, communities, to have access to these things?
I just was at a conference talking about preventive medicine and public health, and I like to think of this not as an education problem. It's not even a law and policy problem. It's an engineering problem in that we need to design where kids go to school, where we live, work, and recreate, to make it so the healthy choice is the easy choice, that the healthy food options are available, first of all, because they're not available in all communities. They're not, grocery stores are not available in some neighborhoods, and then make it more affordable. So once you have the knowledge, you then have the opportunity to put that into play.
We're talking to public health expert Patrick Remington about the recently released, this is from the state, the Healthy Wisconsin Report.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to change in Wisconsin to become a healthier state? What health initiatives are there in your community, maybe that are working? Have you personally made any lifestyle changes for health reasons? And how did you do it? Call in at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our discussion with Dr. Patrick Remington about the Healthy Wisconsin Initiative.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of health areas, like smoking or drinking, do you think Wisconsin should work to improve? What health initiatives do you see in place in your community? Have you been involved in something like this? Maybe you work for a local health care provider, a city planner, a community member. What have you done in your area, and what would you like to see? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, I want to get into at least one more of the focus areas here. Suicide is something we haven't talked about as much, and trying to lower the suicide rate and suicide attempt rate here in Wisconsin. What kind of public health initiatives can maybe make a difference there?
Well, first of all, I think it's important that suicide be viewed as a public health problem. It's not just a problem related to mental health or health care. Second is it's important to understand the root causes. For example, rates of suicide attempts are higher in children with many adverse child experiences. And so that won't help the risk today, but certainly investing in the future. If we have better environments, better opportunities for young children, we're going to see better health down the road. And finally, we just need to align our healthcare policies with what the evidence shows to work. We had caps on the amount of care people could get for mental health in the past. And there's even talk about capping that in the future. That will absolutely reduce the amount of care people are able to get who have depression or are at risk of suicide if we go back to a policy where we limit the number of insurance dollars that could be spent on mental health issues.
Well, speaking of mental health, that ties into another one of the action areas, a very strong overlap for opioid addiction and people with mental health concerns. This is something that might help with both of these problems, mental health access.
And I'd say if there's one new public health problem in the 21st century that's come on the radar, it's been opioid addiction. Opioids have been around for a long time. In fact, there was a time when, and still continues to be, people who should be prescribed opioids who have pain that is where it's appropriate, such as at the end of life or cancer-related pain. But we've been too generous in prescribing opioids and not careful enough in monitoring the consequences. And so there's a well-known initiative in this state and around the country to do a better job of monitoring. And it's not that we need to avoid the use of opioids. We just need to prescribe appropriately.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. John is with us on the line in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. Two things. I think gardening and urban agriculture, we could expand that to make sure that more people have access to vegetables and good food. And also, I think it's very important that suicide be thought of as a health problem. Depression and anxiety and the so-called mood disorders are physical health problems that can often be fatal if not treated right.
John, thanks for the call. Let's start with that second point first, agreeing with you on the importance of treating mental health problems as health problems.
Yeah, and there's stigma associated with mental health. In fact, one of the goals in the nation is to reduce stigma related to mental health, that this is not something people should keep secret or keep away from their family or friends. It's something that we should talk about, just as any other physical ailment. 50 years ago, people didn't talk about cancer. They kept that secret. And I hope we see a day when we can talk about mental health as if it were a disease of the brain and not a moral failing.
Could the same be said for addiction, for that matter? And we are starting to see more people talk about their family's experiences with addiction.
There's no question that recognizing addiction for what it is, which is a disorder of the brain that can be treated, can be prevented if we start early enough, but certainly can be treated if detected and treated appropriately. But stigma remains a problem in that people don't seek care, people aren't as supportive within communities or within the families of those who have these brain diseases.
And John had also mentioned, getting back to the exercise and nutrition side of things, maybe the value of urban agriculture as part of that engineering process you were talking about to get more access to good, healthy food.
I thought the same thing. It is really a way to design for health, that if we promote eating healthy fruits and vegetables and are concerned about the cost, by promoting urban agriculture, by putting farms that are accessible nearby communities, but also gardens in everybody's yard. We don't have a blade of grass in my yard. It's been substituted with gardens and natural plants. And that's a way to design our property so that we don't have to worry about chemicals and weed killers, but actually get the benefit from growing vegetables.
John, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about public health here in Wisconsin with Patrick Remington, looking at a new state report, Healthy Wisconsin, calling for action in a number of health areas, looking for measurable improvement on things like alcohol abuse, nutrition, opioid addiction, suicide, tobacco use. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Milwaukee. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I wanted to comment on Dr. Remington's statement that he feels that the problem is not an educational problem, it's an engineering problem, and I agree with that. The question that I have is that why have we engineered our educational budgets so that schools cannot afford what they need? So they need to line their entranceways with Coca-Cola and Pepsi machines so that as students enter that building, they're enticed first thing in the morning with purchasing sugar. So it's just a question I have.
Steve, thanks for the call. So the presence of unhealthy foods in schools, this has been a debate for a while.
Well, it's no different than hospitals. The hospital I trained at in Seattle has now removed the McDonald's that was put in 2 decades ago. Public no longer tolerates McDonald's in hospitals. In fact, they've gone towards really healthy food choices. I think the same has to happen in our schools. We need to design that environment so that, again, making the healthy choice the easy choice. There's a school in Marshfield that took sugar-sweetened beverages out and replaced it with water. First of all, easily accessible fountains, but then they branded their mascot Tiger Water so that kids felt that it was not only a healthier choice, but a more loyal choice to the school to have a bottle of Tiger Water, which is basically what you should drink when you're thirsty.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. One more action area that we haven't gotten into from the state report is tobacco. Now, my understanding is over time, we've seen tobacco usage go down among adults and kids, and then we kind of leveled off. We've plateaued. We've stopped making progress.
Well, two things. We have leveled off, and we're at about 17% of adults. But I want to make a really important point because the progress has been good, but it's been very unequal. And we have tenfold differences in smoking rates. Right now in Wisconsin, I just checked the results. It's as low as 2% among women who give birth. If you have a college degree, it's 20% if you didn't graduate from high school. 60% if you're low income, down to 6% if you're high income. So these tremendous disparities in smoking rates have been created because of the progress we've made. And if we don't address them, we'll see cancer rates and heart disease and chronic breathing problems in people with less education and low income. It's definitely going to come.
And I wanted to ask about those disparities because that doesn't just come up in the area of tobacco in this report. Suicide is another area, addiction. How do we start to is it a matter of reaching people with that information who aren't getting it, or is it this, again, an engineering issue?
I think it's a design issue in that many times we implement programs that, as designed, lead to disparities. When they're designed with information requiring literacy or resources. So we need to design them right and from the outset think about the impact of an intervention, a policy, or a program on people with less opportunity, with less income or less education. If you design it right that way from the outset, then you're less likely to see these health disparities develop over time.
Well, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Associate Dean of Public Health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joins today to talk about the recently released Healthy Wisconsin Initiative. Still time for you to share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know what's going on in your community when it comes to these health issues we've talked about, issues of binge drinking, alcohol abuse, tobacco, or boosting better nutrition, better exercise. Again, tell your community story over at the Central Time Facebook page.